Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
AI won't replace authors. It will replace bad authors. An unfinished series is far better than a completed series with a severely disappointing or bad ending.
If I was not less dumb, then I could speak the good.
Welcome back to another Tudor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm the other host, Richard.
New studio chairs. Feeling good.
New furniture. Always good.
Oh, I almost put my feet up. I gotta not do that. Okay, I was told not to get comfortable. We did hot takes from the patrons on two videos that came prior, and we can link those in the description below. And our patrons submitted some big hot takes. There were some we very much agreed with, some we very much disagreed with. We decided, you know what if you and I, Rich, came up with our own hot takes? We have a video coming out, which will be next episode of your hot takes, but this one is focused on my 10 book hot takes.
I'm so happy to judge you. It's like taking my passion or hobby and making it more professional. Like, this is what I do in my free time, and we're doing it for the actual podcast. It's so great.
You just disagree with me on the regular.
Yeah, generally, most of the time.
The sticks have made a return. The agree and disagree sticks. Now, since these are just going to be my hot takes this episode, Rich, you're going to show whether you agree or disagree with me. So you'll say, yep, Hey, I agree with you. We'll have a little bit of that. Then we'll play a little devil's advocate if you do agree with me. So if you find yourself agreeing with 9 out of my 10 takes, we'll go, okay, agree. Here's why I agree with you. Then give me some pushback. Try to represent the audience that might disagree with the hot take.
I am always great at playing devil's advocate. It's arguably my favorite thing.
I would argue it's not your favorite thing.
Yeah, but that's where you're wrong.
I'm playing devil's advocate.
I know, but I'm devil's advocate. I need to argue with you.
All right.
I agree with you, and so I have to. Yeah.
I see. It's never ending. Okay.
It's never ending.
Hot takes. Are you ready? I have 10 of them. And I also want to say this. All 10 of these hot takes, I tried to go affirmative and say, no, this is what I feel. Of the 10, there's 4 in-depth hot takes, and the other ones are 1 or 2 liners.
Okay.
And I'll see what you think about them, okay?
Sounds good to me.
Hot take number 1. An unfinished series is far better than a completed series with a severely disappointing or bad ending. Now, what do you actually think? That's my take.
Okay, here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have wavered on this one. You've made compelling arguments.
Okay.
But overall,
you disagree. Okay, actual disagreement.
I actually disagree.
Mm-hmm.
I value conclusions, and I will take the risk of it being bad than it just never being done and being forgotten as half finished. I would much rather have a conclusion,
yeah,
whether good or bad.
Now, what leans you toward that? Why'd you waver at first? What made you waver with thinking about that a bit?
Oh, it's measuring the disappointment of never finishing something versus the finality disappointment of a bad ending. And which one is worse? And I'm trying to think back to series where it just won't be finished. And so my disappointment there versus the series, something like Lightbringer for me, is one of those. I love the series, hate the ending.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things, that is a certain level of frustration, but at least I have a conclusion. I have closure.
Something to look on, yeah.
But why do you prefer you would rather not have an ending at all? You'd rather just be left in the ether and you just to never know versus a conclusion.
Yeah, this is why this is my take. So it comes from two specific experiences. One isn't even books. It was Game of Thrones, the show.
Mm-hmm.
Game of Thrones, the show, everybody knows how horribly that ended with season 8. It was so abysmally bad. It ruined any enjoyment I could ever. I can't even look at the seasons I love. That's how much it affected my enjoyment, because knowing where the characters end up, their destination, it's peak television at certain points. Seasons 1 through 4, 6, I think even up to 6 was awesome. I think 7 and 8, but 8 is for sure where it went completely downhill. It hurt my enjoyment that when a series ends so badly, it makes me think less fondly on the things that I loved so much. Now, this is to a less degree, but definitely was it. This is where we were starting to talk about this and make this point, was after we finished Stormlight Book 5. When in truth, we're not spoiling here. All these takes, I should say, I should put this earlier, but this will all be spoiler free as far as we're not saying takes of, oh, I hate this book like these books. These are broad book hot takes.
Other than the thing when I said I hated the ending of Lightbringer.
But you didn't say like what happened in
that
Lightbringer.
Is true.
Yeah. It's just saying you disliked it or liked it. So we had this conversation after Wind and Truth book 5 of Stormlight Archive. We both did not like that one bit. I do understand.
We have beaten that horse to death.
We have.
And then we keep beating.
So I don't want to focus on it other than saying, yes, I understand book 5. There's 5 more books afterwards. Stormlight's not done. But this was arc 1 of Stormlight Archive. Now, Stormlight Archive still has some of my favorite books, with Way of Kings, Words of Radiance, Oathbringer. Oh, 5-star books for me. And Wind and Truth being, as much as I didn't like that, as bad as that was for me, makes me just look at Stormlight and go, oh, that point of view character. Oh, now when I read the things that were building up to that, what I know is the conclusion, which I'm not saying which parts, you can look at our Wind and Truth review if you want in depth, but I can't look at the character's journey and without this bitter taste in my mouth. With that being said, I still love those prior books. I look at them as more self-contained, so I enjoy them a lot. However, then when I look at an unfinished series, the big ones, I've only read book 1 so far of A Song of Ice and Fire, but I'm even thinking of the 5 books that George R. R. Martin has out right now and being unfinished. Of, at the very least, what the book has going, the book series has going for that the show doesn't, is the book series still has the hope of, maybe not hope of it's going to come out, but at least the feeling of, oh, at least we don't have the hate, the wrath. At least there's still the chance. And the cool thing about the unfinished series, if there's a tragic thing where an author passes away or something happens where it's not because of the author not writing it, such as Ruffus or what's another one? Well, George R. R. Martin. Locke Lamora, writer Scott Lynch.
Scott Lynch, yeah.
So in those cases, at the very least, the community that's sitting there and theorizing and trying to think what could happen, there's still some of the enjoyment of almost the hope, to me, is better than disappointment. That's what it comes down to. I so strongly feel this because I don't want that joy to be sucked away for the thing you love. Endings matter a ton. A funny thing about Stormlight is it says Journey Before Destination.
Destination kind of matters.
It matters quite a lot. You know, it's, hey, it's the journey on your way to North Korea. That's what matters. Not you actually landing in North Korea and going in the camps. Where you're going matters. If you're just going to random airplane, like, wow, best airport experience of my life. I had 5 guys. I hung out and then you land in North Korea. No, it matters where you land. And that's what it comes down to. That's my hot take.
Interesting. Yeah, I would still say I disagree, because I don't like those kind of stories occupying my head, because it becomes an itch for me.
Oh, okay.
And I, like, there's a certain level of, there's a certain amount that I'm willing to tolerate it, to the point where I start becoming a little bit more bitter of, like, it's just constantly unfinished, and it's just, I want the itch to be scratched and go away. It's too much for me. I would rather just, and even ending it poorly, at least it's done. I can move on to other things and it's not going to sit with me for decades.
We can both agree. We both prefer a good ending.
Yes.
That's the ideal world. No,
real hot take. I prefer bad endings to books. That's what I desire most.
I get off on failure.
I just live off of the hate from Reddit. That's what I get. I bring great joy and pleasure from seeing Reddit nerds cry.
You know what I've been enjoying, though, is having bad beginnings.
That is the more we have read in this kind of space, how many of our favorite series have just like either bad to okay first book?
I just wasn't like, invested book one. I don't get it. Then you read book two and you go, oh.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yes. Oh, no, that's happened to me so many times.
Malazan.
Malazan for Sun me. Eater. Sun Eater, definitely.
What else?
God.
That's two at least. I'm also... things that aren't coming to mind, but are definitely the case.
There's... I'm trying to... if I'm looking at the shelf right now, in all honesty, Discworld really is there.
I didn't read book one yet. I've skipped around. Yeah,
we'll get there. Just power through books one and two.
People say that for Red Rising. I do love Red Rising book one, but people will say that.
That was the case for me. I liked book one quite a bit, but it was book two that hooked me into the series.
Yep.
Honestly, Wheel of Time was the same thing. That was the big one where I barely read book two. It was more of a like, I got nothing but time. I already bought the second book. I thought first book was fine. And then I read book two. I'm like, oh, this is actually fun. Oh, this is cool again. All right, cool.
It's cool again.
I'm a fan now.
People say that about Bound of the Broken. We haven't read book two, but book one of Blood and Fire, I believe that's the name of it. Mm-hmm. I didn't like that, but people tell me book two.
Same thing with Jade City.
People, I think people do like book one more than us.
People like book one, but we've heard from our own friends and from the Patreon as well.
Yes.
That book two, all the things that we actually still did like about the first book were given a lot more time in the second book.
Yeah.
So it's a very different book. So I still want to read those books as well. But yeah, I guess that's less of a hot take, is that you should give a book two a chance, even if you don't like book one.
I swear, if that's in your hot take video, I'll be deeply disappointed. I want some juicy takes. Oh, yeah. You already disagreed with my first one. So that take was, I'd rather have an unfinished series. Give me that.
Quick pause from the video of Austin's terrible, terrible hot takes.
Amazing hot takes.
And you know what's not terrible? World Anvil.
WorldAnvil.com. You can go onto their site to get an entire catalog and toolkit to build any type of world, character, plot for your D&D campaigns, your writing, whatever quest that you want. If you have a hot take and you just want to explore your hot take to the depths of hell, you can go onto World Anvil and look at any tool such as their map making kit. The thing that you love the most.
Yeah, the characters, the character sheets. So you're able to actually build quite easily a nice family tree of characters where you can write in your character sheets, and it's all well organized for your whatever. Right. If you're using these character sheets for D&D, awesome. If you're using these character sheets for your writing, also awesome.
You can use code RAMBLE at checkout to get 51% off a yearly subscription, but also just check out World Anvil and you can use it for free. If you want that premium subscription, remember, use code RAMBLE. Thank you so much to World Anvil for sponsoring us. And I think that World Anvil, they 100% back my hot takes is what this means if they sponsored the episode, right? That means everything I say.
Maybe don't check out World Anvil then. No, I'm kidding.
Can we say that legally? No.
I don't know. Check them out. They're definitely actually out. A lot of the features are there for free. And if you want more, you can always pay them. Use the code RAMBLE.
Oh, yes. Thanks, everybody. Back to the episode.
Thanks.
My second take. You ready?
Give it to me.
This is one of the longer ones. And then there'll be short ones. I stacked them. Okay. Mm. Here we go. My hot take number two is about the death of the author. Now, for those of you, I'm going to explain death of the author just in case audience members, you don't know that. Death of the author, it was this article. I don't know too much about it other than the take from the article. We will be reading it and reacting. I think that would be cool if we have a whole episode on it. But essentially, it argues against the traditional literary criticism's practice of relying on the intentions and biography of an author to definitively explain the ultimate meaning of a text. Essentially, it looks at the author, says, no, it's up to the reader. That's what the death of the author is, hey, forget the author for a second. And I'm summarizing, I'm making it simple, but look at it's your reader's interpretation. Now, here's my take. Okay. The death of the author is stupid. Yes. And by the way, we will be reading the full article. So this is somewhat of an ignorant take, but take me for just give me this. Okay.
This one. Just this one?
Yeah, all of them. So my hot take is, the death of the author is stupid. Yes, the author can unknowingly or subconsciously include symbols, themes, and other things that the reader picks up on, which the author did not consciously think about. But in the end, the author's intentions and role in the story reign supreme. Just because a reader interprets something differently from what the author clearly intended, the reader is wrong. The author is correct. There are objectively wrong ways to interpret a story. That doesn't mean you can't be subjectively moved by your own incorrect interpretation, but you should acknowledge your interpretation is incorrect and not what the text is trying to accomplish. Also, that doesn't mean you can't have tons of different interpretations and take something unique out of a read that other readers do not. The author may have even accidentally moved you to tears because of something that you personally connected with. That is totally fine, but you cannot project and say that, for example, The Lord of the Rings is not a story about temptation and a fundamentally Catholic-inspired religious work, or inspired by his faith. The author's background, upbringing, bias, and beliefs matter wholeheartedly. What makes an incredible book is when the biased author explores a theme, its characters, its story in an honest way, allowing it to develop without breaking the rules they set in order to fit their own narrative. What makes literary analysis incredible is you can be moved by stories in vastly different ways while acknowledging what the author was going for. When this happens, true art meets true criticism. You cannot ignore the sculptor in order to understand the stone.
You really wrote that one out.
I wanted my full thoughts.
Might as well just... Do you want a Substack? You want to respond to this?
Do you agree or disagree?
Correct.
Oh, okay. That's why you're upset. You agree. You wanted to disagree wholeheartedly.
I do want to disagree. And thing is, you answered that very tactfully. Because I've quite enjoyed... works where clearly I was taking something away from the medium that the author, the creator didn't intend. And it's valid enough to like that I experienced it or that's what I took from it. But you're right. There are kind of like objectively wrong takes. Like there's maybe criticism where maybe it's not what the author intended, but there's at least some logical argument of like, fair enough. Like, you can argue the way it's...
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it's not what the author intended, but there's a good argument. But there does have to be some kind of acknowledgement of... There are times people are just wrong, where they just got the facts wrong. They misremembered parts of the book. It's like... Even if they remembered parts of the book wrong, I'm... To carry on your thing with Lord of the Rings, of people taught, like, their interpretation that... Orcs are actually representative of black people in Middle Earth. And it's like, incorrect, just wrong. It's just not true. And if that is your interpretation, you're incorrect about the story. And you are just adding villainous intent to Tolkien. And I think that's wrong to do. And so, yeah, there can be wrong takes.
I think this is the article. There was some article that also inspired this from me. This might be it. Was the title of it was saying Noel Tolkien's Lord of the Rings isn't Christian, or it was that, or a like-minded article that was talking about how...
Well, they were saying like Tolkien himself isn't Catholic.
One of these articles out there that was saying something about Tolkien and what he meant in his works, which clearly he has essays written. We read
about means with his works.
Exactly what he means. So it's very clear what he intended. So it's just people, I think, projecting and going what they want the story and the author to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay that you get something out of it and something different, but there are things that the story's going for.
It's also perfectly fine to like go, like have your own kind of theory about it, like, hey, here's how I view it.
Yeah.
That, I think... That is the better way of seeing. It's like, hey, here's how I view the story.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with that. When you're trying to impugn upon the author of, oh, the author actually meant this, or the author is this, the story means this. This is what it's going for. You can just be wrong.
Yeah. You could definitely be wrong about it. And this doesn't take away, because I feel that the article or this thing, The Death of the Author, was made to go, hey, the reader and your experience means a lot and it does matter, which I want to give.
I think it's trying to deconstruct the hierarchy of reading to the readers of there is no hierarchy between author and reader, and that we're all, once it's out there in the ether, we're all on the same playing field. We're all on the same level.
Hmm.
And I think you and I would agree that there is a hierarchy of value between the author and the reader.
Yeah,
the
author, one and two.
One and two. The author's right. opinion about their own work matters more than the reader. Hot take.
And more so opinion on the facts, because, for example, hey, we bring this up all the time in our Sunday reviews, but Rocchio's favorite book happens to align with me if he loves Howling Dark the most. That doesn't mean that his fan base can't love Demon in White the most.
Yeah.
You know?
I was joking with him. Exactly. About no, Rocchio, you're wrong. Yeah. Book three is actually so much better. And he's No, Rocky, you don't understand. You don't understand about your own book.
Here's where the validity to in interpretations of a book, or I said a lot in that essay of my hot take there, and one of them was how the author can unconsciously put things in there that the reader finds. And this is a great 30-second interview clip where Steven Spielberg, going into films for a second, after his film Close Encounters of the Third Kind was released, he got this interview question. And just take a look at what was being said here. And if I can scroll, there we go. Take a look at this.
Your father was a computer scientist. Your mother was a musician. When the spaceship lands, how do they communicate?
That's a very good question. I like that. You've answered the question.
They make music on their computers, and they are able to speak to each other.
And you see, I'd love to say, you know, I intended that and I realized that was my mother and father, but not until this moment.
Point being that this interviewer looked at Steven Spielberg's past and was seeing, oh, what did Spielberg intend with this? And Spielberg didn't consciously go, oh, this represents my mom and dad and my upbringing at all. But the interviewer, through looking at Spielberg's life, went, is this what you meant by it, essentially? Spielberg going, no, but that makes sense. It's essentially what just happened. And so I think that says a lot about, hey, the author even unconsciously put something in there that was representative of their life. You can't take out your upbringing. You can't take out your bias. So that was one part of it. But also, he didn't even know that.
Yeah.
So I it's a cool part of yet that you could even bring more out of the work by looking into the author. And at the same time, I don't want to pigeonhole. What do you think about this, I guess? I think Terry Pratchett with the book Small Gods, which was to me and to both of us, a great book about faith, of what the good faith being something, not faith over religion was one of the messages of it, but just looking at how it made an argument for atheism, but also made an argument for true faith in a way. It had both of those, but Terry Pratchett is an atheist.
I think one of the more important scenes in there is kind of some hypocrisy from the kind of scientific community on how they treat faith and religion. Yeah. Especially with the scientist, it was surface level joke that goes much deeper in the book, but basically, scientists constantly questioning things to the point of just a ridiculous nature of like, oh my God, move on. Well, why does it fall? And they just keep asking so many why questions that they end up coming up with nonsense, when the better thing to do is just accept some things and move on and ask some hard questions. Mm-hmm. But they constantly ask why.
Hyper skepticism.
Yeah. Exactly. So it showed some of that ridiculous nature. I enjoyed that. Yeah. I enjoyed seeing this, but on both takes. It was good.
And I'd say what Terry Pratchett did, obviously he's an atheist, but if mm-hmm. he wanted to just go his entire narrative, the story would have felt weird. It would have felt preachy and weird because he didn't explore the theme he was going for in an honest way, which is that part of what I was saying there.
You compare that work to season two of Good Omens. I think
I haven't seen that.
So Good Omens.
Also, can I unplug these? Both of these. I just want to make sure I don't shut things down. Continue. Yeah.
But no, you compare Good Omens season one, which, yeah, it's a mockery of Christianity, but I would say it's a little bit more good-natured. Season two is pretty much Christianity kind of sucks and God's pretty bad. Also, God's a woman. And just it's a straight up kind of a mean-spirited mocking of Christianity and Christianity is wrong.
No, it's not. It's pro-Christian. it's up to my interpretation.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So take that what you will,
But for the most part, also, season two deviates further from it, and Good Omens itself is not is only partly written by Terry Pratchett himself. So anyway, that is, I think, more means that story is a little bit more mean-spirited than something like Small Gods.
Oh, yeah. Small Gods is not mean-spirited. Does not. Yeah. I want to see, just before we go on to the third one, any pushback, if you could represent some of the audience that disagrees with that, what would you say, the steel man the argument in that way? Obviously, we agree, but if you had to, if you had to give pushback.
Ultimately, if a work, the purpose of art is to get across, like, interpret some meaning. It is supposed to make you feel or think something.
Yeah.
If it has accomplished one of those two things, isn't that valid enough? And that if someone looks at a painting and cries and the other person cheers with joy, who are you to call whichever one is wrong? Like, they both experience it in a different way. And how is one more valid than the other? Just because the author wrote it one way and felt a certain way doesn't mean everyone must feel the exact same way about a book.
Good argument. Yeah, good argument. And that's also, there's a lot of stories, I'm trying to think some on top of my head, of where the author wanted this person to be a bad guy or a good person, and the audience takes it a different way, and that's frustrating.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I can be on the audience side or the author side and just go, no, we shouldn't, this is not somebody to emulate. No, the Joker is not literally you. Okay, so that's that take. Want to go on to my third hot take?
Yeah.
Third hot take, which these are all correct takes. AI. Oh, also, get ready for your agree or disagree.
Also?
Yes. Oh, what do we got? Oh, yeah, good idea. Okay.
AI. The blue light.
It was shining. Shining.
It was messing with the camera. We're good now.
AI won't replace authors. It will replace bad authors. What do you think? Disagree. I knew you'd disagree on this a bit.
I disagree. But,
So we've talked about this a lot, though. And what do you think? So you think it will replace authors?
I think there's a significant problem that AI does is it doesn't just eliminate the bottom rungs of any kind of division. If you eliminate the bottom rungs of any industry, you prevent the development of newer, higher-end individuals. And you honestly make it difficult for people in those industries to work at all. So AI does need to be the best author. Like, they don't need to be they don't need to rival the Stephen Kings of the world. They just have to be good enough that it siphons enough money and away that basically really good authors just can't financially exist. And then I think we see something of the like with TV and movies. If you see how the industry is kind of suffering from their own type of success in the sense of there's way too much. And the fact that they are pumping out so many different TV shows, people just can't watch it all. So individually, even shows that are critically acclaimed, technically monetarily successful, are just not as successful as shows used to be because there were less shows. There were fixed time slots. You had to tune in. And so you would have, 30, 50 million viewers in a night. That's huge. And that's great for advertising money. Now, a couple million, and that's pretty good. I mean, that's somewhat worse than most YouTube channels. And so there's...
Not ours.
Not ours. But YouTube frequently gets bigger numbers on certain channels. So I think AI will face a problem with volume. That it will make good enough slop that people will want to read it and will take up. There's only so many hours in the day for people. And that instead of a smaller pool of authors, we now have a much larger pool of slop that is okay. And that people will consume over better
stuff. You think we'll be the Wall-Es. We'll all love the slop.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. No. I think
we already love the slop, maybe. Maybe there's a lot to be said there.
AI video. Yeah. So the problem is the volume. The minute AI gets good enough for a passable stories and they're able to produce it within
that's
a day.
That's the first thing. Because that's part of the conversation. Do you think that AI will get to the point of being able to write a book as good as some of these books behind us? You don't have to say the best of the best, but because my take is AI won't replace authors. It will replace bad authors. That's where my take is. So what do you think? You don't have to name the book behind us, but you think it'll be better than some of these?
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll get there.
What would you say? Estimate.
Oh, when?
Yeah, when. But when do we have to fear?
Honestly, I think with less than a decade.
Okay. You're thinking like 2035. We'll give it that year. Okay. If the podcast is still here, we'll play this clip.
Well, thing is, I think people have to be worried about like movies. Everyone's kind of seen the Studio Ghibli AI stuff. And it's not perfect, but it's pretty damn close to copying Ghibli's art style that takes hours and hours. So I think it's a good example of the problem that I kind of see in the future of Studio Ghibli's art. Maybe the AI is not as good as Ghibli, but it's good enough. And with the same amount of volume, it now loses its luster. And so why would someone pay to go see a Studio Ghibli movie, which comes out very rarely, and it's special because it's unique, when someone makes a passable movie in the Studio Ghibli style, and now it's everywhere. It's no longer special.
Well, to retort to that, maybe the same reason people look at the Mona Lisa and not replicants of the Mona Lisa. We only value the original. Like, we would value the one created by an artist rather than duplicates.
True, but how many people have... a lot of people they don't look at the Mona Lisa anymore. They take a picture of the Mona Lisa to show that they were there. I don't think a lot of people do actually appreciate art. Like, there's a handful of people that appreciate the originality of it, but most people are very satisfied with just the image on their phone. Why do people go to a live concert and then film it?
I don't think you're giving people some credit there. You got to give a little bit more credit. Yeah.
People give no credit.
I think with art like that, so I always use the example, I actually do think what AI will do in stories, it might replace some on a lower level, like not that there's a bunch of bad authors creating works, but as in it will force people to have to improve in writing. In the same way, I always use this example of chess. I've said this to you a bunch of times, but
wasn't there a recent chess master that was able to beat a the current best chess chess?
I didn't read about that. Do you know the name? I mean, Magnus Carlsen's the number one in the world.
Magnus Carlsen was referencing somebody else was able to beat AI. Like, out of 100 games, was able to win like 52 of them.
No way. I didn't see that. I would have been if it was against the best AI.
Or at least one of I. We'll talk about it later, because I saw it scrolling and I didn't really think it would come up in this conversation.
I didn't hear about that. I would doubt it. I would be shocked if that was the case, because chess AI is, you just can't physically beat it.
I believe Magnus Carlsen was mentioning that the human did have an advantage.
Oh, he's given something.
Yeah, I think he was given an extra knight or something.
Oh, well, then I could see that happening. Yeah.
Still, but it's more of like,
hey,
that's still damn impressive.
Oh,
one of the best chess AIs, and you're given one extra knight. Like, the AI should be perfect. It should sweep any human, even with significant advantage.
I think Magnus Carlsen with one less pawn, he could take him. But the point with chess is Garry Kasparov versus Deep Blue. This happened back in the 90s, where a computer beats the grandmaster in chess. And devastating. Every chess player now pales in comparison to computers. But since Garry Kasparov lost, ever since then, chess players have gotten better because they could learn from AI. They could learn from what's the actual correct chess move to make, because the computer knows better than humans do. So it improved gameplay, but also chess is bigger than it ever was. It's had a resurgence. Queen's Gambit helped out with that. But also just chess as a game, proliferated even more. And I think a part of that is, I say this a lot, that humans are more pro-human than we think. You could watch a perfect chess game right now. You could watch Stockfish against Alpha Zero. Those are two of the chess engines. You could watch that. You can do that. Gotham Chess, I watch him on YouTube. Recommend. He's the best chess YouTuber out there. And he'll show games of Alpha Zero versus Stockfish for some fun. But he gets most of his clicks by going, Magnus Carlsen beats a 9-0 in the freestyle chess tournament, da da da, which was huge, by the way, historic. The other day, Magnus Carlsen won all 9 games in a tournament in freestyle chess, which, to break that down, freestyle chess is, you know, a chess is normally set up pawns in front, and then you have your king and queen and all your pieces in a specific order. Mm-hmm. Well, freestyle chess, I believe it was invented by Bobby Fischer, who was U.S. Grandmaster, beat Spassky or whatever his name was, with big Cold War type stuff. But you know Bobby Fischer, vaguely. Yeah,
vaguely.
I believe Bobby Fischer started it, where he was so sick of chess and just how it was so formulaic that everything in the back rank, the back line where your rook and your knight, bishop are all there, get randomized. So you put them anywhere in the back rank. So your king could be in the corner instead of in the center. And the opponents get randomized to where yours are. So instead of there being one setup to the game, I think there's 960 or 360, some number I'm forgetting top of my head, that there's that many positions. So you can't prepare, because it's beyond the, you can't prepare an X number of openings for 360 different types of board play. So it makes it the game more intuitive of, oh, you have to know the game and be able to react to however the chess pieces are set up. Anyways,
I have a video to show you later.
Oh, hell yeah.
Of a fun, basically an engineering chess video where they made do you know timed chess?
Oh, yeah.
Where, like, each piece is, like, you can move, like, both players, there's no actual turns. There's no turn chess.
I might not know this.
You basically just get to move, and what determines on when you can move a piece is, like, when you move a piece, it has, like, 5 or 15 seconds before it can move again. But all pieces can technically move at any time. But there's a countdown, so they have a chessboard where with a magnet that holds the piece in place and has like a countdown on the piece.
Oh, that's chaotic.
And so you have to watch it like a hawk, and you get to move the piece. But
throw in chess boxing, and that makes it even better.
Yeah. Anyway, it's.
That's sick.
I think it was a very cool engineering project because he took it from, of course, you can do that online. It's easier.
Yeah.
And he made it physical. So.
Oh, sick. Oh, which YouTuber is that? Shout him out.
Just a guy. Oh, just a dude. I think that's his only video on there on his channel. I'll look again.
You're killing it, man.
I'll look again, but it was cool.
But yeah, point being, Magnus, you don't, in a tournament, Grandmasters, you don't win all of your games. That doesn't happen because you draw a lot of them. Magnus and any other player that's that good, because when chess is played perfectly, it ends in a draw. Right? Mm-hmm. A perfect game, you play so well that you have to draw the game. But he won, first time in history, 9-0, won every game. Didn't draw a game, didn't lose a game, but it was historic. Anyways, back to the point of...
Here's an interesting distinction.
Back to our... AI
humans
thing, yeah.
Humans being able to learn from AI makes sense because AI can play chess to a level of because it is a game
mathematical,
there is a perfection. And so because chess is so much better, humans can learn.
Mm-hmm.
There's something different with AI and writing where you're right completely. I don't think AI will ever get as good as like mastery level authors like
Magnus Carlsen of the book world,
which to me is almost worse. You know, if it could write a perfect novel, you're right, maybe humans would just actually improve upon it. But the fact that it can't do that means there's less to learn from the AI and more that the AI is just taking up space and resources. That is more my concern. It's not like its level of quality. It's just there's only so much resources to go around to authors and only so much time for readers to spend, and it's going to take up an exorbitant amount of the books on the market, and it'll take up resources. My concern,
I guess, to that, because that's a different take than most of. I think the people that say AI will replace authors usually say, oh, it will get as good as authors do.
Yeah.
And so if you don't agree, I guess to that take, that's good, at least the if you're a good author, really good, you'll stand out from the AI is what you're saying. So you do agree with that portion.
Yeah. I just don't.
Maybe we don't disagree, because my take is AIs won't replace authors, it will replace bad authors. I guess bad authors being it could replace, if you're producing.
Maybe so. I just was harping on, like, I think you'd have to be not just like a not bad author. You have to be really good.
Okay, you're saying that AI will still be really good.
The slop will be too much.
Okay.
You not only have to be good, you have to be great.
Yeah.
To stand out.
I would say, though, even right now without AI, you already have to, as an indie author or an author, you have to do a lot to stand out already. I think
it's due to volume.
Yep.
Imagine 100x that problem. Books can be created that are at current, like, slightly below average quality to a ridiculous margin. All books. The minute, like, already books are not super, like, new books are not that valuable because there are a lot of authors already.
Okay.
Imagine you multiply that with the power of computers, and, like, it's more than 100, it's 1,000x times, 10,000 times.
It could be a million.
Infinite times. Like, at what point, then, are books basically valueless?
I think, you get a good point. I think that law of diminishing return. That point. I honestly think already right now, that it's such a diminishing return. If you were to 100, 1,000, 10,000x the number of books already, and it was all AI stuff. Let's say it dropped right now.
Mm-hmm.
Billion books just dropped. I even still think with that, it wouldn't change too much. Just because it's how many infinitesimal number of books that we can never read from it, let alone traditionally published, the amount of indie books that are coming out that you have to. The only reason those AI books would stand out is if somebody reads that and then goes, hey, that was pretty good. It was AI. I don't care that it was AI. I'm still going to post about it on my platform and get others to read it. It still takes marketing several layers to go, okay, this is of value. Read this AI slop. I still think it would be tough.
I'm just kind of comparing it to my experience with TV and movies. That the amount that the slop increases, the less I consume in general. Like, it will take a master. Like, I just don't watch TV anymore. It has to be master level TV for me to even bother watching.
That goes into my next take. I'm moving my eighth take, putting it fifth fourth, just so I can move it so it's relevant to right now. How do I work laptops?
You can mute it.
Oh, there it is. Got it. Okay. But no, to your point there, anything else with the AI? Because it seems like the disagreement is you think there's going to be so much out there. There's going to be so much AI slop that authors won't be able to. How do you produce faster than the AI does? They're producing what you're producing, but more and faster.
Yeah.
Okay. And maybe that's a disagreement, because I think it won't get to that really good level. It won't get to the level where I think the John Gwynns out there, they're still going to be successful. It's tough because I it's one of those things of, we'll see.
Yeah, true.
We'll see. See you in 10 years. All right. We'll see what happens.
The consequence of me being wrong is a better world. So I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah. Good point. Okay. This is my fourth take. I moved this up because it was a little bit what you're getting into. So my fourth hot take. Stories, books, films, and television today are just as good and bad as most other times in history. Yes, there are some standout years where multiple incredible works are made and years where a lot of very bad is made, but on aggregate, the same percentage of good and bad stuff is being written. There's just more volume being created today, so we have more good to appreciate and much more bad that we can cry about, that we are in the dark ages of horrible storytelling. We look back fondly on past decades because of survivorship bias. Typically, the good stuff is what survives and what we remember. Curious, what do you agree or disagree? Because the way I worded it, maybe you agree, maybe you still disagree. Let me see here. Okay, you agree with that.
Generally agree, yeah.
But you still have the problem that there's a lot of bad. And you're going, like, there's a more lot of bad, and I don't like it.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you think about that? Because you agree with the same percentage of stuff is being made. It's just, so let's say, for example, 1920, there was, this is not the case, but let's say there was 10 movies made in 1920. 9 of them were bad. 1 was great, good. And today, multiply that and say there's 100 movies made. There's now 90 bad movies. You're like, damn, that's a lot of bad movies. But there's 10 good ones. But there's more numerically bad ones.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? I guess you agree that
it is probably true. Like, yeah, I mean, depending on year to year or every half decade, I think, what is it, like, average film creation time is kind of like five-ish years, like from...
Is that the case?
From basically start to finish of a movie project, you can average it out 5 years. There's, of course, ones that take a lot longer and some that are shorter. But my point being of, like, that's a good period of, like, generation of, like, when trends can change and when studios and executives or just creatives can pivot.
Yeah.
Basically, in a 5 years period of, like, yeah, superheroes, awesome. And it's like, it's going to take 5 years for a course correction. So, like, because their movies are going to come out and they know it's going to suck. It's like, people are not having these anymore. But, well, for the next five years.
You're already so far into that production.
Yeah. It's like,
you can't just go, whoa.
You can't just, there's basically a 5 year, like, turnaround timeline. And so, if you look at it, and there's some 5 year periods where there's less good movies and less good books and all these things. And some periods where great stuff comes out.
I think we exactly agree then.
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, what would you say to, because I do agree, there could be a couple years like, oh, well, nothing really good. But the more time you give, the more you look at a decade or a period of time and go, it somewhat is percentage
there,
balance.
Is there some type of is there some type of value in older uses of the English language? Has the English language gotten worse, or has it just gotten different?
Oh, has it gotten worse? Are you thinking because we've been reading a lot more?
Well, just listen to how we talk. We speak worse than our grandparents, and we speak worse than their grandparents. Like,
you're giving me heavy...
No.
Yeah.
Not on average. Like, you know, we speak worse than the highly educated of... a regular whatever our education level is, we speak worse than generations previous.
That's a good point to make, because then if you looked back at literacy, just got a whole bunch better over the years. So you can't say, oh yeah, we speak better than.
I
get what you mean.
There are degrees I'm trying to wrap my head around, like, actually articulating this properly, which, again, if I were better spoken, I would be able to articulate my thoughts better.
Proves your own point.
If I was not less dumb, then I could speak the good.
Oh, what was that? Gum. What's that? The Night in the Museum? Dum-dum, give me gum.
Oh, that was...
That gave me a flashback. Sorry. You got me going. Okay.
That's a...
That's a deep
core
cut.
Core memory.
speak, gum. So... I see what you mean. So do I think that we are less eloquent?
Yeah. Do you think the English language has gotten better or worse?
No, I just
think
a bunch of schmucks have podcasts now. And so people look at, oh, wow, look at how much society has fallen. Anybody can have a podcast mic, hence us having a podcast mic. So maybe that's part of it, where if you dive.
There's a lot of people that have a microphone that just don't deserve a microphone.
I think, that's social media. You are now, you project your voice into the ether. I'd say, I see what you mean. There's an archaic way of English that just sounds fancier. When you hear a British person talk, you go, oh, I trust them because it sounds fancier.
You have a better accent.
Exactly.
You're Cockney.
The correct accents, though, because there's some British accents that I would never trust.
Yeah.
I don't know how to distinguish them.
Birmingham, basically.
I don't know what the exact accent is, but I'll trust your take.
Basically ghetto Londoners. It's like that. There's a type, and it's like, yeah, they sound filthy.
Their accent, how would you compare it to US? Like, you know, you got that Southern drawl, but Southern drawl
sounds hospitality.
It sounds fancy sometimes.
Sometimes. It depends on
depends
on what type of manner they're at. Are they?
My cousins also told me that I have an accent. I almost spoke in an accent. My cousins told me I had an accent. I was going, what? No, I don't. We speak the same. But to them, I even had a weird Northern accent of some sort. I was going, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I always felt I don't. And I do actually my tone of voice will change pretty easily, depending on where I'm at.
It's also egocentric to say, oh yeah, I didn't think I had an accent, or you have an accent.
Oh yeah, no, you
never
think
my accent's correct, of course. It's just how you speak, though.
But that's just the overarching question of, can language over time be better or worse? Or is it just all change? And there is no
better
such
worse.
Thing as a, like, oh, English is evolving, but... Like, is it evolving, devolving, or is it just change?
Are there more beautiful languages? Is Arabic or Spanish? Does it sound better? Now, I think the weird thing with English, we have, I don't know a bunch about etymology, but the Germanic and Latin roots and certain words, just we combined a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, it seems to be the trend etymology over time is the shortening of meanings. Of you take longer words, make not just words, but you and make them shorter, but you take phrases, make them shorter. And that's the general trend of etymology. And when generations look on the younger generations and are horrified by their lingo, they're horrified. Like, almost all of it is to take a larger concept and make it smaller. Like, Riz is... dumb word. It's cringe for the alpha kids, but you know what? It means actually something. It's a longer word of charisma. That's all it is charisma shorter. I don't know really any of the, I don't know what skibbity toilet is supposed to be.
I think it's
nonsense and it means something. Yeah. Is a thing.
I've never heard you say that. Funny thing, I've heard you say skibbity. I've not heard you say that, though.
That's a word that it's a shorter way of saying something else that I will not repeat here, but that's fine. They know. Or you could look it up. But my point being, is there value in... Is it better that words and meanings and phrases are getting shorter, or is it better that they're longer?
Now, I'll take your word for it. It seems like as though a lot of slang or the terms that kids pick up and that we used a bunch of slang when we were,
we still do,
but it's just our generation's slang. That's all it is.
Basically, your
generation slang.
Millennials are looking at us going, you guys are using a bunch of dumbass words.
Exactly.
Yeah. Every generation does it.
Yeah. And so maybe those slangs are shortened because there's also slang in the past that we wouldn't recognize as much because it just went out of our diction. You go, there was some presidential election in the 1800s where some slang term was used and it was a campaign slogan and it was used against something that some college students back in the day used and whatever called the candidate that I'm forgetting what it is now because we don't use the slang term anymore. But I can't answer that because I don't know enough. I guess my opinion is I generally feel similar to stories. There's more people writing stories today. There's more stories proliferating. There's also more people speaking. Also, we hear more because this exists. Internet exists. I want to say you could still find just as well-spoken people today. But you also have more of a chance of seeing those well-spoken people slip up because the stuff we're looking in the past was all written and thought through and they published it. And so I bet you if you heard, I've heard Tolkien speak also on, I've heard some, he's also very, he's very well-spoken. Exemption. But you take,
even for his time, he's really well-spoken.
But you take somebody that's written something long ago and you never heard them talk though.
You want to? Like, test this theory?
How so?
I have a bunch of old-ass books. Pull one at random.
Just hear it. My point is, you can read that, but you wouldn't know conversating with them. Do they still speak as eloquently on page as they do off page? Because even you and I can sound a little bit more intelligent.
A tendency for previous generations to sound smarter on page than they do in person, where maybe today people are trying to sound on page like people speak? Is there a type of, it's the whole Sanderson transparent prose where he's deliberately trying to be a bit more transparent, but he's trying to be a bit more clear for people to read it as people actually speak.
Yeah, I guess until I learn more, I'll say it's my same take as in the story stuff. The percentage is there.
There's it's still, just more.
It's more. There's more bad. There's more. Same amount of good and bad. Just percentages. Percentage same, number bigger.
I forget what I said. Did I agree with you or disagree? I think I agreed with you.
You agreed, but I think you should start disagreeing more. This next one, you're definitely going to disagree.
All right.
You have to say what you actually think. So, okay, here we go. I'm also getting used to the new set. I'm just making... Okay, good. Because sometimes our recording goes off. That's happened before. You're going to have to use your glasses and check. I usually... All right. Here's take number five. Hot take number five is this. Genres... And I think you will disagree with this. This will be fun. Genres and settings with darker elements such as cyberpunk and noir have far less fresh and insightful themes than neutral or positive genres and settings. The messages and themes in cyberpunk and noir 9 out of 10 times say the same thing in a very similar way. Gloom, existentialism, and nihilism can only get you so far, so those stories should focus on their character plot or other aspects because the theme is so incredibly tired. That's my take. I think that's a very hot take for, he's thinking. I got him thinking at least.
I'll still disagree.
Okay. But do you actually disagree or?
I do.
Okay.
But barely.
It's close, right?
I get what you mean.
Yeah.
It's honestly very similar to kind of one of my hot takes. There is something similar.
Are you
to
saying
a,
it in your hot take or is this different? Okay.
I will.
Okay.
Yeah. But there is something to it of dystopian grim novels, like, yeah, they definitely have something to say, but how many times can you just say nihilism? It's just it's a fresh coat of paint on things, like, I get it,
things suck. things are not skibbity toilet.
Things suck, people suck, everyone sucks, society is corrupt,
like, yeah, that sucks.
Just, yeah, no, I get, yeah, you, like, yeah. There's only so many ways. There's a finite amount of suffering, and there's kind of an infinite amount of goodness. It's in my mind of like it's kind of future goodness, like the possibilities. I imagine the hopeful possibilities are just kind of far more numerous and infinite, and far more imaginative than just everything sucks. Everyone wants to die. And life isn't worth
it. It's cyclical. It's whatever it is.
Like, no matter what way you go to get there, like, there's a bunch of creative ways to get to life sucks. No one wants to live anymore. Society's corrupt. Like, all these different things. Yeah. Like, think of the two books, like 1984 and Brave New World.
Mm-hmm. Gets there in different ways.
They are different. I understand one is focused far more on the individual and like the corruption of your fellow man versus, you know, corruption of a government. Mm-hmm. They do say different things, but ultimately both dystopian novels kind of end in the same place of, you know, maybe, you know, be cautious of, you know, totalitarian regimes. Okay.
Right.
How many times can you tell that story in different ways?
Right.
Versus Star Trek. Say what you will about it, like, they'll have bad episodes, but because Star Trek is a very hopeful story, it has just such a wide variety of stories to tell. Almost every episode can have a different message and a different idea, mainly because it is hopeful. And it's why I like plenty of different TV shows. But
one of my favorite genres is variety. Coming of age.
Yeah.
You could see why coming of age, and not to... I guess, why do you disagree then? Why do you disagree?
Because I like all the... There's a bunch.
You like that stuff, yeah.
The thing is, yes, maybe it is a bit more finite. Mm. However, there's... Just like every other type of story, there's plenty of ways to do it. The examples I already gave of 1984 and Brave New World are dystopian novels, but ultimately say very different things. Neuromancer, for me, I mean, I haven't read that many cyberpunk stories. I think that was the only one I've read, at least. And I don't think there's a ton of cyberpunk stories out there. It's a small-ish genre. I mean, as far as sci-fi genres go, I don't think it's that big. So, I mean, there's plenty of stuff to tell there. I don't think it's overused. So
got it. Yeah,
I'm fine with more of them.
Yeah, I put noir, cyberpunk. There's probably others. I think some westerns fall into this. The certain type of westerns, not all though, because you can have different. Western is just a setting as well. It's not just more so with, I guess, cyberpunk type of setting, but noir is more of a feel. You associate it with detective, etc. But the you made my point for me. Like, I agree with everything you said, essentially, of there's a lot more ways to discover hope than there is to fall into darkness in that kind of way, where I just find it more interesting of how do you get out of it than the cycle of whether it's existential nihilism, you take those. The stories I do love more that are humorous or absurdism with your, not just Discworld, but Hitchhiker's Guide with Douglas Adams, but your, those kind of stories and themes, I think my focus on those, when I don't like those stories a lot, or I guess when I'm not wowed by them. So I love Blade Runner, the movie. That's a great movie. I don't say love it. Great. Really well done. It's cool. I think there's a lot with those cyberpunk and noirs. It's if it relies on punching you with that theme, of that dark theme and that dark element. Like, I felt that a bunch. Chinatown does it 10 out of 10. Like, Chinatown is a top tier noir film. But then once I've seen that and I go, okay, I get the noir, I get the cyberpunk, and then the following cyberpunk and noirs focus on that dark theme element and just says it in a different but less good way than the other thing that I saw. You got to give characters plot, some twist, something that it's more than just, oh, this is going to be gloomy at the end, because I know I felt that. I get it. Like that. Okay. Thank you for the warning message and theme. Cool. I'm more optimistic. But then just my point with that is focus on something else has to also be very elevated to be interesting, whether even if it's world building ideas, Neuromancer. I didn't like the book, but at the very least, it had cool world things of going, oh, this Matrix, and it was early for William Gibson's time. So I guess that's the thing. I need a noir or cyberpunk, something to have something else. I'll even say this for First Law, which is more, it's grimdark, right? But it has awesome characters. And I think because I was so riding on the theme for the third book, which not spoiling anything of that, but since I was going, oh, what's the message? What are you trying to say? Like, oh, you know, but the characters top tier. So it's, if you also do something else, I can get more invested in the story, but I get a bit tired of that kind of stuff.
Is it possible it is more just a victim of being popular? That, take noir, for example, noir being especially more historically a very popular genre with just a vast amount of stories that, obviously, it's going to be a little bit repetitive at some points, and plenty of people that, because it's popular, will just make a generic noir story, and so people get kind of sick of it. Same thing happens with superheroes, same thing happened with westerns, and that because grim or dark stories are just generally more popular, we see more of them, and so you're kind of tired of them. Rather than, it's not necessarily or something wrong with the genre, it's just the volume. And so, like, I've read enough of that. Move on to something else.
That's a good point. I would only say no for this reason. If I never, and maybe this is unfair to compare a type of trope to a setting genre, but for example, coming of age is my favorite. I've never tired of it. I will do infinite coming of age stories because it's also focused around band of characters. What's the lesson you learn? Is it about, it can go in a lot of different directions. Again, it's more of a storytelling style, so that's less fair, but I guess I've gotten more tired of those negative genres than I have of the other types of settings and genres. So superheroes, for example, I think since there's a lot more coming out, you can not like stuff, but I haven't written off superheroes in that sense of just going, oh, I don't like cool powers and stuff anymore just because there's been a lot of bad superhero movies. I'm still good. Spider-Man's still awesome. Cool. Come on, Spidey-Man. yeah, I guess that's where it's from. I also am less read than, oh, shoot. Hope I didn't delete a take. There we go. I mean, I'm not the most read in grimdark type stuff either. I've already read less of that and feel that way where I've read the stuff I like. So obviously I've read more of the coming of age stuff.
Fair enough.
This is a take that it's hard to, like, anybody watching just go, oh, I have different tastes than you, Austin. Okay. That's really all it is. Yeah. Do you want my sixth hot take?
Yep.
You do.
I was like, man, do we have time for 10?
Oh, what's the time at?
An hour.
Oh, you want to split it into two? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Oh, okay.
Just pick your favorite ones okay. and we'll stop.
My sixth hot take of the 10.
We'll try and be quicker. We'll try not to make it a 3-hour video.
They deserve 3 hours of these hot takes. The next hot take.
No one wants that.
Everybody wants a hot take. Okay. Here's the sixth hot take that I have. Fantasy and sci-fi take the most skill of any genre to write successfully. He's thinking. Where do we got him? That's why the episode... Agreed! Yes. Yep.
I don't agree with you.
You agree with Tolkien.
Agree with Tolkien.
Yes. It was one of the... We read in On Fairy Stories, and he makes a great point. And I think very simply why we both agree on this hot take is Tolkien explains that in fantasy and sci-fi, you are working not just a primary world with agreed upon rules, but you're transporting somebody to a secondary world. That's what this immersion is. That's what you, when you are lost in this, truly escape into a story and can believe that something else is a rule. It's this magic trick, this act that's being put on where you can actually be transported completely is hard to do because you have to, one, make sure the reader's taking you seriously. These talking rabbits or these flying zombies, whatever weird thing you have, they have to suspend disbelief so much. You have to set up a world so incredibly believable with these made up rules and this make believe that's your first task. And then you have to tell a good story. So that it just adds that layer of difficulty. And do you have anything? Because we both read the same thing from Tolkien.
The argument being when people read fantasy and sci-fi, they suspend their disbelief more so than if they were to read a fiction story that takes place in our own world. And because they suspend their disbelief, you have an easier time writing it. I would argue people don't suspend their disbelief as much as you would think. Like, if it doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense, and people won't agree with it, and people won't jive. So, I'm in agreement with you.
I guess a counterpoint to, if you were to disagree with that, what would you say?
I mean, that was my point. Suspension of disbelief is in favor of fantasy and sci-fi.
I see what you're saying. I thought you were using it as defense. I see. You're saying that is
the argument of it is easy. Someone would say it is easier to write fantasy and sci-fi because the reader suspends their disbelief more than in a fictional.
I understand.
A fictional story in our primary world.
Got it. And maybe that's even the case of you could see it. The person could see it as easier because since you're just able to make up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I have to write within rules of I can't just have a dragon save the day or eagle save the day.
Yeah. But the argument to that would be you live in the primary world, you understand and you know it on an instinctual level.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little easier to write in compared to a world that you have not lived in, no one has lived in, because you have to create it all yourself.
Yep.
That's harder.
That is.
Imagine if you had to come up with the traffic system. And you're writing a story like cars don't exist. And traffic, you go, well, how do cars get around? And you have to think up the combustion engine. It's hard.
And obviously, fantasy sci-fi relies on we have knowledge of the world. So when an element is introduced, you go, oh, okay, I understand.
It's like the combustion engine, but instead of...
You invent something else.
Instead of the fuel of the dead lizards, it's using magic.
Well said. All right. My seventh hot take.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, this is one of my favorite ones. This is one I feel pretty strongly about it, but I'm okay with it. Does that make sense? Okay. My seventh hot take is, in general, the larger the scope of your story is, the more uninteresting your main antagonist or villain is. Epic fantasies and space operas often have their big bad either represent something, such as darkness, etc., whatever, or they simply believe the ends justify the means. Stories with more narrow scopes, so the smaller the story scope is, have far more nuanced and interesting antagonists. Curious what you think.
Yeah, I agree.
You agree with that? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a work of skill to write a large scoped story, but still keep the tight focus around the characters' motivations and journeys. And that many authors, I think, confuse the scope with interest. So, like, a large scope, big stakes is entertaining. It's an entertaining setting, but it is not entertaining in of itself. Like, the world ending it's not important in a book. Like, oh, the world is going to end. That doesn't matter. What matters is that character's world is going to end. And so there's plenty of authors that, I guess it's just more of an amateur thing. I think plenty of good authors realize that it's about the character's personal journey, not the grand scheme of it all. I mean, that's the, I was about to give away a big spoiler, but I'll
hold off on that one.
I will hold off on that one. It's quite literally like last chapter of a series. Never mind. That'd be a big one. Hold my tongue.
Without spoiling those, you see those big epic scope stories. And I know we've said this to death, but I'll give other examples. Lord of the Rings. Sauron isn't interesting.
Yeah.
Just it's a figure that represents the theme. And it's great for that
reason. Represents the theme. Yeah. If you're going to have a villain that is not in and of themselves interesting, you either make them in
group. Yeah.
Either one, you spend as little time with them as possible. Make them.
Yes.
You don't want page time with them directly because they
exactly.
Scary things are scary from a distance. The closer you get to the source of something scary, the less intimidating it becomes. But also make it charming, make it charismatic, either, you know, negatively charismatic, or they're just.
I mean, I love my Red Rising antagonists.
Yeah.
The Red Rising antagonists have that charisma. It's very cool. But other series, Stormlight, the big bad, and I'm not going to spoil anything here, but think the big bad for Stormlight. Think the big bad for even Wheel of Time. I haven't read further than book four, but I think you'd agree with big bad, or maybe you don't because something happens beyond book four. But
there's a
point.
There's Robert Jordan does it correctly.
Okay, there you go.
He learned from Tolkien. He understands how to actually
got it.
Address that. Yes.
And then even Sun Eater, where Sun Eater, the villains are sick, but the individual antagonist, you know, think that Harry Potter, how much are we going? Voldemort is the most better. Or even think Thanos, which I think Thanos has done super well in Marvel, but in this big epic scope narrative, it's still, and do the ends justify the means if he's trying to save everybody? I do enjoy Thanos, but when you get to these big antagonists, it falls into that. It falls into represent big theme, represent thing, darkness, boom, boom, send the cannon fodder, or and justify the means, big antagonist. Because when you're talking galactic or world scale, what else can the villain do other than that? There are plenty of exceptions, but in general, do feel that way. Whereas narrow scope stories, your antagonist, who maybe they're not even a villain, they're just that protagonist's obstacle, can get so much more intertwined and represent and push back against your character's character arc, which makes it interesting. They're what your character could turn into. I guess Lord of the Rings, the best antagonist in Lord of the Rings is Sméagol.
Yeah.
Gollum is the coolest antagonist part because we get to see what Frodo could become. It's not the Sauron who could destroy everything. It's Gollum is the most interesting antagonist. So when your big bad is generally less interesting.
It's something I've actually come to enjoy with Malazan. I'm only two books in, but I think I'm starting to get a hint of, now, hey, maybe later books I'll be proven wrong on this, but I'm starting to get the hint that there are no actual villains in Malazan at all. There's just antagonists. Like, everyone's an antagonist to somebody.
And what you mean.
That's the story. That there is no.
There was a reveal villain. In book two that might. Yeah, that
you get what I mean?
Yeah, I think I see what you mean.
And I'm starting to see a pattern. I'm going, and it makes them more interesting. I'm like, oh, okay. We're just all have shifted. Like, it's kind of fun.
Yeah. It's different than boom, one individual. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Any pushback on that take?
I agree with you.
Okay. The eighth hot take. Indie books are proportionally far worse than traditionally published books.
I mean, just pure numbers. How does anyone disagree with that?
But I do think that I know, like, you agree with me.
That's proportionally, but yeah. Yeah.
Yes. I do see a lot, though, of...
I've seen way too many, like, self-published Minecraft books to, like, I can't not agree with that statement. You know how many Minecraft self-pub stories are out there? Or, just, like, there's so much self-pub slop out there.
Do you think that's that's my least hot take, then?
Okay.
Do you think that's the coldest take I have?
But there are going to be people in the comments are like...
What do you think they'll say? Vehemently
different.
Well, the people that disagree, what do you think they'll say?
The best stories I've actually read are self-pub. And,
well,
like,
actually, one of the best stories I've read is self-pub.
Exactly. People don't understand proportionality. If I've learned anything being on the internet, is people don't understand numbers. Like, trying to explain to someone the difference between the average and the mean is frustrating.
So you would say, then, again, proportionally speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, you totally agree. Yeah.
It's higher number, lower, like, yeah.
Way more indie books are bad.
Yes.
Whereas traditionally published, way more, less are bad of traditionally published by far. And that's obviously because it goes through more rigorous testing. Also, the same case, indie published, the barrier to entry to make an indie published thing. Mm-hmm. Same reason why, if you go on YouTube versus Netflix in general, the YouTube production and everything should, in an ideal world, YouTube videos, if you just take literally every video on here, a lot more are going to be bad.
Yeah.
Because anybody can upload a YouTube video.
Most YouTube videos suck. They're awful.
But you don't get those recommended on your algorithm.
Yeah.
You get the good ones. Like this one. See? That's why you're watching this one. So, but then you go on. Yeah. We agree.
Yeah. Okay.
My ninth hot take, and these last two are where I think the most spiciness can be done. And by the way, if you're watching this video still, comment down below after the 10th hot take is said and let us know what number of hot takes did you agree with me. So was it 8 out of 10? Was it 5 out of 10? I want to know in the comments and which ones you disagreed with. Because I think so far you disagreed, was it 2 or 3? Does somebody have a counter? What's it been?
I don't remember.
We'll see. I think it's 2. We'll see. Yeah. We'll find out. All right. So
It should be a disagrees across the board. I'm upset that over the 2 years we've been doing podcasting stuff together, you've learned.
I've learned, yes.
You've educated yourself.
I think so far it's been, you disagree with number one, that's the author, AI, you disagreed with that one, you agreed with that. The genre is one you disagreed with, right?
Yeah.
That's 3, fantasy sci-fi, yes. That one, yes. You've disagreed with 3 so far. Our counter is 3.
Okay.
Let's see if we could change that up. Can you disagree with half these next two?
By the way,
this next one, you're going to agree wholeheartedly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The last one you'll disagree, so I think it'll be 4. But this is my 9th hot take. Yeah, you're going to agree. No matter how insensitive or offensive to modern sensibilities, an author's work should never, under any circumstance, be modified by anyone besides the author, unless there's an obvious spelling or printer error.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. You obviously agree with that.
I am generally a fan of offensive things on the surface. You said,
modern sensibility.
I'm like, yes. Yes, of course.
Offend all the sense and sensibilities. Offend all the prides and prejudices. All of them.
It's great. I enjoy it.
If you're not offending, are you saying something that's true?
Yes. That's exactly it.
If nobody is offended, are you actually saying something of merit? Don't say it then, you know?
If no one's offended by what you're... If no one can ever be offended by what you're saying...
But you mean zero goose egg.
Goose egg.
Goose egg zero.
Then you're saying something not worth saying.
I 1,000% agree.
That's... Okay. This is the problem with small talk in general. It's the most infuriating thing is people say, like, people are afraid to have conversations with strangers or acquaintances of which to have disagreement or invite conflict.
Yeah.
And so they say things that offend nobody and can offend nobody. Hey, man, this nice spring day is really lovely weather we're having, isn't it? Yeah. Man, it rained last weekend, didn't it? That was pretty bad. Yeah. It offends no one and it's boring as hell. Offend someone. Be willing to risk it all.
Next time your grandpa asks you, hey, is the weather going? You say, no, because the housing crisis is fucking killing me, grandpa. Okay, that's what you want to do.
I would rather be wrong, like 9 out of the 10 things I say, than be stuck or afraid of just saying nothing of consequence. I'd rather be wrong. And like, it's at least fun to be corrected. Incorrectly or correctly corrected.
But here's the thing. We're only on the first part of this.
Yeah, no, we already
are. The first part is offend people. Yeah!
Yeah! Yeah.
But then to
then
to the actual hot take.
Okay.
Oh, what do you think on the hot take?
You're going to have to remind me. I stopped listening after offend people. I'm like, yeah.
No matter how insensitive or offensive to modern sensibilities, author's work should never under any circumstance be modified by anyone besides the author themselves, unless there's obvious printer spelling error.
I'm deeply offended by some of the recent,
Hey, then they're doing something right if you're offended.
Yeah. Mm, yeah.
See?
Best thing. Someone. But yeah, point. I like it. Good job.
You just, after a rant about offensive, you go, I'm offended by that.
Yeah. But thing is, I like living in an offensive world.
Yes.
I am perfectly happy with someone's offended by my statements and vice versa. That's how we figure out what's actually right.
Right. Point being,
I'm deeply offended by the Roald Dahl stuff with the publisher. And actually,
I'm vaguely familiar with that.
So basically,
it was about the fat, right? I remember,
bunch of them.
Yeah, catch us up because I'm not entirely in the loop.
A bunch of the stories use the words like, you know, fat witches or obese, ugly stepmom or something like that. He uses very colorful language about things. And so instead of the publisher just not printing the book anymore, which sad, but at least fine. They decided to edit the story. This was the first pass that they initially decided to edit the story and change those words to less offensive terminology than print the book the same. This is the book, and tried to pass it off as Roald Dahl's actual book. And the new phrases make it way less colorful, way less enjoyable. If it was written that way, it wouldn't have become popular because it's just stale. It turns really colorful language into very stale language that is not visually appealing, like into the head. You can't actually, it's a book. Like, you have to visualize the thing in your mind's eye. And if you sterilize the language and sterilize the adjectives, you make it boring to imagine. Anyway, they pass it off, and then they, you know, there's some backlash. They said, okay, we're actually going to publish both the edited version and make it clear, and then we will still maybe publish the original and make sure it say it's original. I think that's a kind of a distinction without a difference, because they'll just eventually stop publishing the original and only publish the edited version, and the edited will just be tiny text at the bottom, and people will just assume it's that. Anyway, I find that incredibly offensive, that you're putting words in someone else's mouth. I don't like it. I hate it.
That does kind of suck, because when you were saying yesterday to me, you said yesterday that you actually differed with what you're saying now, though.
How?
I'm putting words in your mouth.
I didn't catch that one right over the head.
I was just saying you said something that you didn't say.
Yeah, which
it's annoying, isn't it? Like, no, I didn't say that. Like, yeah. That's one of the things of I think Bookborn said this too, which I tend to agree. The frustrating part about YouTube comments, Rich and I really disagree with us, say we suck, all that stuff good. The ones that sometimes would get to me is they either like hard agree with me, hard disagree, whatever it is, but it's not what I said. You know, it's just not it's like, it's not on something that I actually believed, or I must have miscommunicated. So I'm like, damn it. Did I project wrong? Did I say, I would rather have somebody look at something I did agree or disagree, but be correct about, oh yeah, I hard disagree because I actually love Wheel of Time or actually whatever it might be with me. Mm-hmm. But then it can sometimes frustrate going, no, that's not what I mean. Then you get frustrated because, oh, did I communicate wrong? And then you go, oh man, I suck. And then it goes down there.
That's where I disagree with both you and Bookborn. I don't care.
Oh, no, that's fair. That's also fair.
Someone clearly didn't understand my point. I'm like, well, it's either I didn't communicate it properly, or this person's an idiot, or didn't listen. And why should I care?
No, I agree with you on that sense. But the point where maybe we differ of I get it's a reflection of myself going, damn, I communicated wrong. It's, you know, it's something you try to improve on constantly of going, hey, am I speaking without likes, buts, and ums? Am I making my point clear? But if somebody watched this video and goes, man, Rich and Austin, and they went around were like, oh, they really like when authors' works are changed or whatnot. Not in a trolling fashion, but that's their takeaway of this section. I'd be like, damn, what did I say that was made that seem? Maybe I joked around too much and wasn't clear enough. I wasn't firm enough. I blew it away as a joke. Like that's more of the stuff I go, damn, I should be firm with opinions, but I don't know. That's the whole thing.
Hey, that makes sense.
Yeah, anyways, an aside on comment side.
I do want to say the Roald Dahl situation, as far as I've seen, is an exception to the rule. Like it does seem to be an outlier. I don't think it's particularly widespread, so it's not like a thing that happens all the time.
No.
But I don't like it, and I don't want that to be a trend that continues any further than it already has.
Right.
I do see literature as special, almost sacred in its historical value of, able to pick up something and know that these are the words that someone generations past have said.
Mm-hmm.
And then the investigation of what do they mean? There's already issues. And this is just the nature of the problem of translations.
Mm-hmm.
Of did that translation accurately get across the point? Not completely. Some are better, some are worse. We're already dealing with that without the deliberate, like, alteration of someone's words for their novel. I don't like it. So
here's another episode of two reluctant agnostics talking about the Bible. But in the Bible, there's one version. I can't get it right if it was the New Revised Testament, something to the new updated, two different versions. One version where the translation takes a word by word translation of the Greek and goes, this is what that word means today. This is what that word means today. This is what that word, and goes through. Whereas the NSV something, something, one of the two, biblical scholars would know better. But then the other version of the Bible, which there's tons of, but just another one, looks at the Greek phrase line by line and translates it to what did they mean? So for example, if back in the day, the Greeks were the biblical text said in Greek, and it said, it's like I'm banging my head on the table. I don't know, whatever they'd say. But in today, what they mean is, a modern lingo way of saying that would be like, you stub your toe. It's as worse as banging your head on the table. They changed to what we would understand it to be based on translation of, oh, we wouldn't understand that that metaphor that they meant, because no, they said banging head on the table, but today we wouldn't understand that because that's a bad example, because back in those days maybe it was like, oh, I banged my head on a cauldron.
Well, that's
something like that.
That's the reason why most people have a hard time, like it's the reason why high schoolers have a hard time reading classics, is because older novels, even after they've been translated, use idioms that are no longer used today, and also are using references to historical commonalities of its time, of which, you know, us people today don't know. And so there is something to be said of historians being able to actually understand novels and enjoy it almost the same way that someone of that time would enjoy it.
Mm.
Because they can get the cultural references. Maybe they understand more of the idioms and understand what that actually means.
Yeah.
Instead of just kind of taking it literally and going, eh, that's a weird phrase. Fine. And move it on.
Yeah. Does that get you a little bit more afraid of AI in the sense of our voices could be used to say anything?
Oh, yeah. That's already terrifying.
Oh, like don't know if I said the story on the podcast, but my grandparents were called and they swear they heard my voice, and it was my voice in the hospital asking for $7,000 because I ran over a pregnant woman or something. It was a scam caller. It was not me, but they got a call from this impersonating my voice somehow. This was a couple years ago too. The podcast wasn't even that big. So I don't know how that happened. Where voice also, got
they chose yours. They chose your voice, not mine. Is interesting.
What was my grandparents?
Well, no, but like, why didn't they? Why didn't they? Yeah. Use the same bottle and call up my family.
Maybe they have your number. You're more secretive. Maybe mine just plastered everywhere. But it was strange because the podcast wasn't even. It was so early on too. Mm-hmm. I was like, how else would that have happened? I don't know. But anyways, that is that's a whole nother thing of AI and usages and yeah, scary. That's where we need some more cyberpunk noir to scare us into the AI.
See, now I really want like a hopeful cyberpunk story.
Or I would love that.
A positive, like positive spin on a noir setting story.
Andy Weir writes noir.
Oh, I would love that.
Come on.
Oh, Andy Weir, get on it. You're the most hopeful sci-fi writer that I know of, and I need you to write more.
Come on, please. Now. All right, my last hot take. You've disagreed, but I think we're on our counter is three. The last hot take is this. It's very simple. Dream sequences suck. Give me that fourth disagree.
Yeah, disagree.
But hey, the majority you agree, mean you're majority correct.
Yeah.
Only four you disagree.
Why do you dislike dream sequences? What about them? Is it universal or just like dream sequences all suck?
There's exceptions. There's something could work. But in general, when I'm reading a dream sequence, I think one of two things. I think one, I'm already reading a fantasy and sci-fi, then we're going another layer of it's a dream. Is this a story where the dreams are more real and it's affected, or is the dream literally just trying to get across a message or theme or something that the character's internal turmoil will have to deal with throughout the book? I just think there's better ways to weave that in without dream sequence. Sometimes it is necessary with the story, its focus. For example, The Lathe of Heaven, the book is literally about how the character's dreams change reality. And it's going, it makes sense with the narrative. But in general, I read it and go, okay, is this the way of that I'm trying to be, I'm being told character struggle rather than just face the struggle during the story? Or is the dream sequence, I just have to question, like, usually I just get lost and I'm going, nah. Here's a difference too. There's flashbacks is also a way of kind of inputting character motivations and looking back into a story. It's a flashback, but it adds that layer of, I don't know whether to take it. I don't know how to take this yet. This dream sequence, and I just don't like them in general.
Yeah, I disagree with you.
That's okay.
The main thing is you're right. It can be done poorly.
Yeah,
and very often it is a shortcut to get across character motivation or a theme message, whatever it is.
Yeah,
where it's done well is kind of in the extremes. If what you see in the dream could have just been done in the real world, then just do it in the real world. Where it's a lot more interesting is where the dream sequence is kind of really out there and absurd, and our character, assumedly main character, sees something that they could not see in their world. And then it gets a lot more fun and interesting. Like a character that is struggling with, you know, the direct, like a coming of age story and seeing the multiple directions of their life and dreaming the sequences of them in different positions of power and seeing how their life would be different if the previous choices they made were different. And so you get like a little snapshot of, we just already had the character struggling with a decision clearly in the real world. And we see that. Take it up a notch. And now that character gets to see what their life would have been if they made a different decision that they were already struggling with. And us as the reader can enjoy in seeing that. Then we wouldn't be able to see that otherwise. So it's fun.
All tropes can be done well. You are right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just kind of like the miscommunication trope is another one that I typically dislike. But you know what does it really well? My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
It's used as comedy of going that you think you mean this, but actually this is what the person's saying. And that's why there's double entendres and whatever. Yeah, you're right. Dream sequences can be done well.
The main thing is a lot of dream sequences don't go hard enough. You know, a lot of them are just, jump scare, spooky, or like, you think it's the real world, but it's a dream, and jump scare at the end. No. Go deep. Go crazy. Like, take it up a notch. Dream, like, if it's going to be a dream sequence,
okay.
Go hard. That's the fun dream sequences.
I could see that. Yeah, I haven't ran into a lot of fun dream sequences. I've ran into a lot of, oh, here's spooky.
Yeah.
Here's
I get you.
Here's dream sequence where it's just, oh, I'm thinking this is, I'm pained.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's your point. It can be done well. Just if I had this, I just knew you disagreed. I wanted to get another disagree in there. Just you're 4 for 6 or no, 4 out of 10 you disagreed with. Let us know.
Too low.
In the comments, how many of you agreed with my hot takes? Because next episode, we're going to have 10 of Richard's hot takes. And we all know those are going to be hot. How hot are they?
I don't know. See, it's hard to know in my own head because I'm right. They shouldn't be hot takes. I'm having to take my opinions and go, what idiots would disagree with me on this? And I assume better of my fellow man. I think most people are smarter than they actually are.
But you do think they'll fall for the AI schlop.
Yeah, that is true. I'm constantly contradicting myself.
You think
always.
No, you think they're good because you'll give a convincing enough argument.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
I like that one.
Let's see what he does. Thanks for watching another episode. Hey, we have merch, by the way, tutorramble.com. Join our Patreon, description below.
We should normally say that in the beginning of videos.
It's okay. The people that lasted will hear it.
Maybe. We have bookmarks. They are pretty cool.
They are. Do we have any nearby?
Somewhere
over there. Over there. Right, everybody, we'll see you next episode.
Click on it later.
Bye.
Bye.
3 and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.